Good morning, everybody. Glad you're with us on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Last month, the American Journal of Preventative Medicine published a report that grew out of a CDC roundtable in which researchers discuss cancer prevention in midlife. Are there things that people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s can do to reduce their risk of cancer? Well, to help us answer that question, we once again turn to our nutrition diva, Monica Reinagle. She's a licensed nutritionist from Baltimore and the creator of the Nutrition Diva podcast. She's written 6 books, the latest of which is called Nutrition Diva's Secrets for a Healthy Diet. Hey, Monica, good to see you.
Good morning, Tom.
So this is a roundtable report. The CDC had, I guess, a big round table, and they put lots of people around it, right? But we should stress that what they published is not specific guidelines, right?
Right. This is different than the CDC issuing guidelines or recommendations. This was more of a think tank where they invited researchers from a lot of different fields to come together, sit down, and talk about what they're researching and how they see the biggest opportunities for cancer prevention. And this report is sort of the notes from the meeting.
Mm-hmm. And they concentrated specifically on people in midlife, which they define roughly from about 45 to 64. Why midlife?
That's a good question. I think it's because this is a time of life when people start to become more willing to make changes. You know, maybe the specter of aging and disease becomes a little bit more real when we get into our 40s, 50s, and 60s. Because honestly, the things that they talk about, and which we'll talk about in just a sec, would be just as useful for people in their 20s and 30s. I think the reason that this is pitched at midlife people is they feel like they've got a more attentive and willing audience. And this is still in that span when a lot of the disease has not yet occurred. You know, the risk of getting cancer goes up steadily as we age. So here we have a little window where we're paying attention. We're maybe willing to make some sacrifices for our future health, and we're not yet in the grips of active disease. So I think that's why that's the target audience for this.
It's certainly on people's minds as they get into that age, demographic, because all of a sudden you start knowing people. It's not, you know, people's parents anymore who are getting cancer. You start knowing people who are dying of cancer and challenged by cancer. But as you say, it's not necessarily that there are, when we're talking about preventing cancer here, there's not necessarily a whole list of things that you should do, you know, in your 40s, 50s, and 60s that you shouldn't be doing in your 80s or in your 20s.
Right. No need to wait. If you're listening this morning and you're, you know, a ripe old 28 and you're moved to make a change, no need to put that off.
All right. So let's take a look at a few of the things that are in the report. And then we'll talk about some interesting things that are not in the report.
Sure.
One of the things that they talked about is radiation exposure from medical imaging. A lot of people get CT scans and, you know, for breast cancer screenings and stuff like that. It happens pretty regularly. Is that something we should be concerned with?
That's right. You know, it's become a very important part of our medical diagnostic toolkit, and they are very effective in those uses. But the researchers are just pointing out that as use of these tools goes up, we're being exposed to more radiation, and we should be taking that into consideration. They specifically pulled out the CT scans because the amount of radiation involved in those scans is quite a bit higher, you know, 100 to 400 times higher than just a regular old chest x-ray. So they're saying that in particular should be used very judiciously. I think they're kind of speaking to to healthcare providers here, because we as patients are rarely ordering our own CT scans.
Order me a CT scan.
Although sometimes patients will press for more testing. So a little bit for the patients, but maybe more for the doctors saying, hey, let's not go willy-nilly with the CT scans. Let's make sure that they are absolutely necessary and the best tool for the job.
They also talk about circadian rhythm disruption, meaning sleep, getting more sleep, and the kinds of sleep that are better for you than not really can affect your cancer risk.
Yes, and this is something that we started to see with more and more shift workers as we've kind of moved to a 24-hour, not just a 24-hour news cycle, but a 24-hour economy. More people are working overnight, and cancer rates among shift workers, whether it's factory workers or nurses who are working the night shift, is higher. And it's not just about sleep, like how many hours of sleep you get. Specifically, it's about sleeping in the dark. It's about giving your body an opportunity where it is not stimulated by light. And there's a hormonal response that happens when we have dark hours in which to sleep, we produce more melatonin, and that turns out to be a pretty important cancer preventive chemical, so a hormone. So the take home here is not only make sure you're getting enough sleep, but make sure you're sleeping in the dark. And that means turning off all the screens and the phones. If you have to sleep during the day because you work at night, make sure you got some light blocking shades, or wear a sleep mask so that you're getting the benefit of that.
Yeah, so just
dark cycle.
Falling asleep on the living room couch if all the lights are on really isn't going to do you nearly as much good as if you were in a dark room.
That's right.
And they're saying, in fact, turn off your iPhone, turn off your tablet, turn off your computer.
I know everybody's sleeping with the phones in the bed because they're tracking. You know, they've got apps that are running all night. It's not a great idea. But specifically, the light that comes out of computer screens is what they call blue light. And this seems to be uniquely disturbing to the pineal gland, which is the one that produces that melatonin. So, yep, power down those screens a couple of hours before bedtime.
All right, power down. That's Monica Reinagle. She's our nutrition diva. We're talking about cancer prevention for folks in midlife on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. They also talk about weight and being overweight and obesity, as well as alcohol. Let's take weight first. Obviously, it's not a good idea, generally speaking, to be overweight. What's the link between obesity and cancer?
This is huge, Tom. Not only because being obese has such a dramatic impact, you're twice as likely to die of cancer if you are obese than if you're a normal weight. So that's a big risk. But also it's a big deal because such a large portion of the population is now overweight and obese, that the impact of that on cancer deaths is really staggering. So this is important.
They're actually saying that for folks between the ages of 40 and 59, 1 in 3 are obese.
That's right.
That's huge. I mean, that's a lot of people.
It's huge, and those people are at double the risk. So you can see how big the math gets really fast. And this is something, unlike our genetics, which we can't control, unlike a lot of environmental factors, which we can't control, this is something that we do have some control over. And so it does make sense to focus our efforts on things that we can actually change.
How about alcohol consumption? You always hear about people saying, oh, you know, a few glasses of red wine a day is the best thing for you, you know.
A few?
Top it off with some chocolate, you know. It's all just good, right?
Right. Well, there's a little footnote on that, and that is that a very moderate amount of alcohol does seem to have some beneficial effects on the heart, but even a very moderate amount of alcohol does increase the risk of cancer. And, you know, we have a lot of people that are drinking more than that moderate amount, and it's having a big impact on cancer deaths, said to be responsible for about 20,000 cancer deaths a year in the U.S. alone.
Related to alcohol.
Related to excessive alcohol consumption.
Yeah. Of course, the number of adults with cancer is expected to grow because the aging population is growing.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a number of different things that are going to be put into this pot to figure out why there's a higher incidence of cancer. But as this report points out, there are multiple factors that cause cancer. Therefore, there are also multiple solutions. There are multiple things that we can do about diet, exercise. How about exercise?
Exercise directly reduces your risk of cancer. It affects circulating hormones and has anti-inflammatory benefits, but it also has an indirect effect because people who exercise are more likely to be at a healthy weight. And so that's going to play in there too. And you're right, this does get very complex, the way all of the different risk factors and preventive things, combine to produce bigger effects. And we should also just say very quickly that some of cancer incidence is really beyond our control. We don't want to beat people up and make them feel like if they get cancer, if they're diagnosed, that they did something wrong. It happens, even when you do everything right. But all the more reason for us to do what we can do and then, relax and enjoy life.
Sure. Now, there are some interesting things that are not in this roundtable report. And one of those is pesticides. There's this assumption that, eating organic and avoiding pesticides is a really smart thing to do to reduce your cancer risk. I mean, they're throwing chemicals on these crops to make them grow faster and bigger and brighter and greener and redder. It just sort of seems on its face that you shouldn't eat the ones with the chemicals on them. You should eat the ones without the chemicals.
I'm glad you brought this up. You're right. I think it is smart to reduce the amount of chemicals that we put into the environment, to avoid chemicals in our food supply. But the fact is, the reason it's not in this report is that switching over to a 100% organic diet probably would not reduce your cancer risk at all. The number of cancer cases, that's not to say that these chemicals are good for us or that we don't, that there aren't a lot of benefits. I want to be clear. I'm all for cleaning up the environment and reducing the use of these chemicals, but it doesn't have a direct impact on cancer risk. And I think there is a lot of misunderstanding about that. There's not that many cases of cancer that are attributable to chemical exposure, and virtually all of them are people who work with it. One of the big reasons to get pesticides out of the food supply is to protect our farm workers, the people that are actually have their hands in this stuff. They do have a slightly increased risk of cancer, so let's go ahead and protect them.
So it's simply the amount then. I mean, it's the consistency of their interaction with the chemicals and the pesticides as opposed to just, you know, getting it in smaller amounts. Because it just, we're talking about statistical levels of risk factors here. So we're saying, you know, your risk is not improved, or your avoidance of getting cancer, that risk is not improved by avoiding non-organic food.
Yeah, they actually tested this in a population. They had, I believe it was about 9,000 women, and some of them were eating a almost 100% organic diet, and the other others were eating conventional produce, and they tracked them over a whole bunch of years, and the percentage of women that unfortunately did develop cancer during that time was exactly the same between the groups. So, again, not to say there's not good reasons to pursue organic practices, to buy organic when we can and when we can afford it, just to put those risks. What I would hate to do is have that distract people from things that would have a much more powerful impact on their cancer risk, like exercise, like reducing their alcohol consumption, because they're focused 100% on making sure they're avoiding conventional produce or whatever.
So in your work, I mean, you're writing about this, you're blogging about this, you're talking to folks about this all the time. Are there one or two things that folks are consistently doing that if they didn't do, they would really help themselves in terms of, you know, just general health and cancer risk in particular?
Yeah, I think sedentary lifestyle is a big part of it because of its effect on weight, because you're missing the benefits of exercise. And the other thing I feel like, although the organic thing doesn't really seem to tip the balance in terms of cancer risk, eating more fruits and vegetables definitely does. You know, the people that eat the most fruits and vegetables reduce their risk by about 25% versus those who eat the least. So if you're not eating your vegetables, put that on your list of things to do today.
And maybe next time you come, we'll talk about protein and its impact on this, because there are all these diets that are, you know, completely obsessed with protein and sort of to the exclusion of everything else. But that's also interestingly not in this report. They don't identify protein or large amounts of protein as being one of the risks. It certainly didn't make the top 10.
That's a great idea. Let's pick it up where we left off next time.
We shall do that. Monica Reinagle, many thanks. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
Monica Reinagle is the nutrition diva. We've got a link to her most recent blog post. It's about overhauling your diet, and you can find it on our website. Come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.